Scott Bosnecker, and you're listening to Voices from the Center, podcasting from the Overturning Tables website. Once a month, I try to take a day out to clear my head and pray and read and rest, and I typically do this at a Benedictine monastery called Holy Wisdom here in Madison. So last week, I decided to interview the head of that monastery.
My name is Mary David Walgenbach, and I'm prioress at Holy Wisdom Monastery for our community, which is made up of four sisters. Two of us are Roman Catholic, and two are Protestant.
Holy Wisdom became the first Benedictine monastery to open its doors to single women of any Christian denomination. And Sister Mary David oversaw this move to become an ecumenical community. She's a lovely 75-year-old woman, and when I asked for her story, it became apparent that her ecumenical roots run throughout her growing up years, as well as this deep sense of calling to a celibate life as a Benedictine sister.
Well, I grew up in a small town in Iowa. I'm one of five children, the second oldest. And this town has 600 people and four churches: First Reformed, Christian Reformed, Presbyterian, and Roman Catholic. I went to the public high school, and in the public high school, the teachers took turns reading from the scriptures every day, and we all said the Our Father together. My dad was on the school board, so it was a public high school, but that's how it was. And we were a very churched community, and every church had something to say about you growing up. So that's just the beginning of my ecumenicity.
So you grew up in a town where Roman Catholic and a variety of Protestant folk shared spirituality, even in the public high school.
Yes, yes. And then probably, I would say 5 or 6 years later, there was the big consolidation of all those small schools, those public schools, into a larger high school, which then became in the thousands because it picked up students from all the small towns that were maybe 10, 12, 15 miles away from each other. But they all had a high school, which was part of the center of the town because all the kids went there and the elderly went to the plays and the basketball games and the softball games. It was a real hub for the community. And all the church people were proud of their children.
And your parents were Roman Catholic.
Yes.
And there was encouragement to consider service within the Roman Catholic Church, or was that something
that... As a sister?
Yeah, like, was that your idea or your parents, or how'd that come about?
I think all vocational choices are a response to a call from within. And my parents said it was important for me to go to nurse's training and, not join a religious community right out of high school, of which I did. I think the vocation comes out of God's call and comes out of the family, comes out of the community that you live in. And because our ecumenical community in Hospice, Iowa was very supportive of religious people, respected the minister as well as the Roman Catholic priest. We went to one another's funerals. We played ball together. We went to school together. So it was wonderful.
What do you remember about some of your early inklings or sense of calling into the place that you are?
I think it was an admiration for the sisters that had the nursing school I was in. It was also having a spirituality at home, praying at home. We prayed the rosary. We went to church on Sundays. We went to Lenten services. So there, it was a value. And it was something that I think I chose to do rather than be married, because you could be a nurse or a teacher, and you usually ended up on the farm, although I could be a farmer as well. But I wanted something more, and that's just how it unfolded.
Hmm. Have you ever looked back and wished you had made a different choice?
No, not really. I think to be a sister is my true calling. Doesn't mean that it's not been difficult at times. And maybe I wanted to escape it at times, but that's just the fleeting moment.
And what about some of those moments? What have been some of the hardest things about the choice you've made, and what have been some of the glorious things about the choice you've made?
Well, I can remember as a young sister, I went to the University of Wisconsin. I would be dressed in my long habit, taking courses at summer school and sitting next to young women who were dressed in their bathing suits for a physics class. I said, oh, there's something.
You stood out, or maybe they stood out.
Yeah. And then graduating from college here and then being asked to, you know, teach chemistry in our school and, you know, not following my nurse's training. That was a little shift for me. Then when I was probably 34, 35, saying, okay, now is this really where I'm called? Because I had boyfriends before I entered, and I said, well, is this really what I want to do? And I said yes to that. So, I mean, you know, you say yes to your commitment 1,000 times in a lot of different ways, some very insignificant, some that are rather significant.
How about some of the ways in which your commitment has given you freedoms and opportunities that you might not otherwise have if you had chosen a family or a career in nursing? Or
I think it's availability to many different people without being connected to one person or to a family allowed me to do some mission work in Africa and China, allowed me to have an Indian woman and her family live with our community. Her girls were 4 and 5. Their father had died in India. So we could embrace those folk for a period of time.
Sounds like it's allowed you to define family differently in different seasons.
Right. I enjoy people who come out to Holy Wisdom and walk the land and find the beauty of creation that heals and touches their lives. That's very gratifying.
We talked a bit about Saint Benedict. Benedict is considered the founder of Western monasticism. He lived in Italy around 500 AD and created a monastic constitution. It's called the Rule of Benedict, that was so reasonable, so flexible, and so accessible to the masses in comparison with the more ascetic communities that it exploded onto the European continent. Hundreds of communities undertook this constitution for religious life. The Roman Empire had essentially fallen, and a period of chaos and tribalism engulfed Europe. It was called the Dark Ages for a reason. But men and women gathered under the guidance of an abbot or prioress and created these islands of flourishing. Benedict believed in order, and there was something of a hierarchy with the abbot or prioress, but it was a fairly democratic place for its time, calling the brothers and sisters to mutual submission. And he also believed in manual labor and rigorous study, so the Benedictines focused on things like architecture, agriculture, schooling. They produced amazing buildings and these vibrant farms and schools. And there's a poetry to the rule. This is in the prologue, for example. For as we advance in the religious life and in faith, our hearts expand, and we run the way of God's commandments with unspeakable sweetness of love. Now, let me give you an idea of what this constitution for a religious community sounds like. Now, remember, this is 1,500 years ago, so what may seem a bit harsh to us was not really burdensome in its day. On dress, here's what they say. We believe that in ordinary places, the following dress is sufficient for each monk. A tunic, a cowl, that's a thick woolly hood, in winter would be wool, and in summer it'd be lighter. A scapular, that'd be a covering for the shoulders. Stockings and shoes to cover the feet. The monks should not complain about the color or the coarseness of any of these things, but be content with what can be found in the district where they live and can be purchased cheaply. Okay, here's a passage on sleep I thought was a little interesting. Let them sleep clothed and girded with belts and cords, but not with their knives at their sides. I think this is a really great idea, lest they cut themselves in their sleep. And thus be always ready to rise without delay when the signal is given, and hasten to be before one another in the work of God, yet with all gravity and decorum. Benedict made some rules about kitchen duty. He realized that any good community has to have order in the kitchen, and that many communities break up because of the number of bottles of salad dressing or some such thing. Let the brethren serve one another, and let no one be excused from kitchen service, except by reason of sickness or occupation in some important work. For this service brings increase of reward and charity. But let helpers be provided for the weak ones, that they may not be distressed by the work. And indeed, let everyone have help, as required by the size of the community or the circumstances of the locality. The community constitution lays out 72 instructions for good works. These are the expectations for community members. So here's a smattering of behavioral norms for the community. Not to become attached to pleasures, to love fasting, to relieve the poor, to clothe the naked, to visit the sick, to bury the dead, to help in trouble, to console the sorrowing, to become a stranger in the world's ways, to prefer nothing to the love of Christ, to beware of haughtiness, and to respect the seniors, I like that one, to love the juniors. The final expectation is to pray for one's enemies in the love of Christ, and to make peace with one's adversaries before the sun sets, and never to despair of God's mercy. Private ownership is something. It's always been this dangerous snare to those serious about following Jesus. And the church, from its beginnings until just recently, has very seriously cautioned believers about owning stuff. And Jesus himself said in Luke, "None of you can become my disciple unless he gives up all his possessions." So here's what the Rule of Benedict says about private ownership. This vice especially is to be cut out of the monastery by the roots. Let no one presume to give or receive anything without the abbot's leave, or to have anything as his own, anything, whatever, whether book or tablets or pen or whatever it may be, since they are not permitted to have even their bodies or wills at their own disposal. Let all things be common to all, as it is written in Acts 4:32, and let no one say or assume anything is his own.
Well, Benedict lived in the 6th century. His first years, he was a student in Rome, and it was during the time of the decaying of Rome, and so he left the university, and at that time people fled to deserts or to a desert to get their heads cleared. And so he lived in a cave for 3 years. Of course, it's pretty hard to face your demons alone for that time. And the story has it that there were other folks in the desert, and they would come and look him up and talk with him and pray. After 3 years, a group of them said, we would like you to come and lead us. We think it's pretty hard to be living out here by ourselves. And so he did that. He had a group of men that they lived a monastic life. Now, he's not the first one to be living the monastic life. There was St. Basil and Pacomius, and there was the rule of the master. So evidently, there were lots of people who were trying to find their way and felt called either to live in community and to have some place to live and to work and to pray. And so he wrote a rule for people who want to live in community under the authority of the abbot. And we make the promises or vows of obedience, obedience to God, to the abbot, or to the prioress, and to one another. Mutual obedience is a big thing.
And how does that play out?
Well, if I know that you, if you're in my community, and you would like to attend school someplace, but the workforce is pretty thin, and you talk about that in our community, and we all come to an agreement, yes, we will cover for you in order for you to do this. Or if somebody says, would you mind going to the garden this afternoon in place of me, just a little thing, there's a way I obey you. So it's that kind of mutual obedience under various degrees, such as somebody going off to school and you're covering for that person for the year, and so you add their duties to your own, or the whole group does that together.
I also asked Sister Mary David why she thought Catholics seemed to be so great at creating retreat spaces.
The Catholic theology, the sacramental presence, the practices of silence, the practices of community, the different devotional aspects that we had through the ages, reverence for one another, reverence for the elements of the altar. I think that makes a big difference. And, you know, the theologians, I think about Skillebeck, he would say, the earth is the sacrament of the world. The earth, rather than limit it to just seven sacraments, it's the sacramental presence, I think, makes a difference. The emphasis on silence, the emphasis on prayer, the emphasis on personal prayer, as well as communal prayer.
I asked why they left the authority of the Catholic Church to become ecumenical. And she shared about encounters with Protestant monks, the monks of Tazay, and the broken fellowship at the communion table, and about this wide interest in monasticism that they discovered through an interfaith dialogue community that grew up there.
Why ecumenicism? Why is it that you've opened the doors for relationships outside the Catholic Church at maybe some peril or sense of exclusion for yourself, who may not have been embraced by the bishop or local Catholics? And why would you open that set of relationships up when it would mean potential exclusion from some of your own spiritual family?
Well, it really started in the 60s. We had a girls' school, and on the weekends, they would go home, and we would have retreats. The monks of Tazay, three of them, were on the UW campus. Now, they are a Protestant monastic community. They had their white habits. They were very proper monks. And I remember they would come out and have university students for retreats. And we had the Eucharist every day. And they would say, now, when this group comes that is not Catholic, you sisters have to stand up and say, we are separated brethren, and you cannot come to the table. Well, we did that a few times, and then we said, we got to know these people. We did dishes with them. Sometimes we played ball. Sometimes we sang songs together. They started coming to the Liturgy of the Hours. We went to their prayers. This went on and on and on for the rest of the 60s. And we said, look, we're not doing this anymore. We're not standing up. If anybody asks us, we'll say, you need to follow your own spirit. Whatever. We're not saying you can't come to the table. Because they were as straight as we were. In terms of being monastic, you know, following the letter of the law, our churches were separate. We all went by the doctrine that you know, you don't take communion from one another. They have changed radically, radically. So I would say that all of that praying with people of other Christian denominations, participating in interfaith dialogue, which Rabbi Swierczynski, who was a wonderful rabbi in Madison, interfaith dialogue used to meet out here. And they went to the Bishop O'Connor, the first bishop of the diocese, and they said, you know, this is such a nice place. It should be a retreat center. And we were going out and trying to get young women to come to our school, and we had all these other people wanting to come here for retreats. And so we said, well, maybe we need to do something else. So we closed our school and we opened it up as an ecumenical retreat and conference center. We did that through the rest of the 60s and 70s. In 1980, when we celebrated the sesquimillennium of St. Benedict, the 1500th anniversary, we brought together, there was a Benedictine community of women in Eau Claire, and a small Benedictine community in Bennett Lake, Wisconsin. And us, we got together and we put on a symposium, and we put on a program called Then St. Benedict, Then and Now. And we brought together scholars, historians, and we thought, wow, you know, we learned a lot from the history and the different expressions. And so we said, well, there's probably lay people who also want to be associated in community in some way. So we started a group called the Community of the 80s, and we brought men and women together, and we talked about monasticism. And out of that grew a group of people called Community of Benedict that was married people, Protestants and Catholics. That continued until just a few years ago, when the people that started it, at one point when we got to 20, they said, we don't want to grow anymore, because the trust level was so open and the spirituality got so deep, they wanted to stay, you know, and they did. And so just a couple of years ago, they said, well, we need to disband. So how did we become ecumenical? We became ecumenical by association and by prayer with other Christians.
Sister Mary David shared some about the community's journey away from Roman Catholicism that I thought was interesting.
I think, first of all, we should have married priests. And I think of all the married priests who are not allowed to be exercise their priesthood now. I think we should certainly have women as deacons and have the door open for ordination if that's what they choose. Here at Holy Wisdom, because we are an ecumenical community, we, with the help of a canon lawyer and our federation, removed our organization from the Roman Catholic Church. Doesn't mean that I'm not a Roman Catholic. But canon law, which is the law governing the Roman Catholic Church, and each Protestant church has its own polity or its own way of saying that these are the laws by which we operate as Presbyterians or whatever. Canon law says that you have to be a Roman Catholic to make vows. So that stipulation would prevent any Protestant woman who feels called to live the Benedictine life in our community would always be a second-class citizen. So we, as a community, removed ourselves from that. So we're not governed by that part. We're not governed by canon law. Because of that, we're not also not allowed to have a Roman Catholic Mass here by decree of our bishop. So who do we have in our Sunday assembly? We have a resigned married priest who presides at our Eucharist. We have one of our sisters who's an ordained Presbyterian minister. She presides. We have a Mennonite woman who is ordained. She presides. We have an Episcopal priest who is an oblate, presides. And they're all were people who were worshiping with us for some time. We follow one liturgical rite, which is similar to any liturgical church like Roman Catholic, Lutheran, Methodist. We follow the common lectionary, and everybody follows that rite. So we have a wonderful Eucharistic community here on Sundays.
How do you feel about those in the Catholic Communion who would feel like you're not part of the Catholic Communion, or that you're separated, or a sister outside the church?
Yes. Well, I think we have to respect one another's consciences, one another's faith development, one another's expression of that, and there's room for all of us.
And you even have room for them who might exclude you because they're on a journey themselves.
Right, absolutely.
You don't harbor any bitterness toward those who might exclude you from their communions.
No.
I asked how the community there is structured, like who's at the center? Who are the various communities that relate to the monastery?
Well, we have a center which we call the Sisters at Holy Wisdom. That's the celibate group of women. There are four of us. And we also then have oblates who know the rule of Benedict because they come five times a year while they're learning to be an oblate. And then they make their oblation for a year, which is to live the Benedictine spirituality in the world where they are working. And they write a rule for themselves adapted from the spirituality of Benedict. They're going to try to incorporate such and such in their way of life. And so there's probably 200 or so of those people, men and women. They come primarily from the Midwest, Chicago, Minneapolis, Milwaukee, Madison. Many of them are women, although there are a few men. We have Sunday Assembly, which is our worshiping group on Sunday that meets at 9 o'clock. And there are an average of about 180 people that come every Sunday. And then we also have the guests who come to the retreat and guest house, who come for meetings. So the Episcopal Church was just here 2 days ago, and they were here for an overnight and all-day meetings. Some of them pray with us. We pray three times a day, the Liturgy of the Hours, which is the Psalms, the Scriptures, and the hymn. And then we also pray two times in silence, 20 minutes of silence in the morning and at night. Some people come for that. We also have personal retreatants. Many of them are ministers from other church denominations who just need some space. And they can be in the retreat and guest house, or we have two hermitages, and they might go there and have the solitude that they're looking for. Some use the library. Some walk the grounds. You know, they come for various reasons. Some come to meals, some don't. We also have Friends of Wisdom Prairie. That's a group of people who come together to deal with how do you keep the invasive species out of the prairie, or how do you, we've been planting new prairie in the last couple of years, and how do you nurture that? And now we're working on planting oak savanna. So there's all kinds of activities around care for the earth.
We see something of a surge of interest in monastic life in Protestantism, but the truth is that Catholic communities are shrinking and that the Protestant new monastics are really a very, very small group. So I asked what she thought about the future of Benedictine life.
Well, we think that there's enough flow to keep it going, but it won't be as the same numbers we had over the last 50 years, which we say historically is a bubble in our history, that communities were smaller, and we think they will be smaller and are smaller now and will be in the future.
Okay.
So for us, Benedictines tend to be smaller groups than a large apostolic community, and by apostolic I mean a community that is there for ministry. So like you have the order of preachers, the Dominicans, theirs is to do education and to do preaching. Whereas Benedictines live in community, in a local place. Their main work is the liturgy of the hours, to pray every day and to do a ministry, to serve the local people in some way. We always have service as part of our lives. But there are all kinds of experiments. You know, if you go back in church history, there were co-ed monasteries. There are monasteries now that are made up of lay people and celibate women or men. Let me see. There are Protestant monasteries, not as many as Roman Catholic, but there are Protestant monasteries that follow the rule of Benedict. So it seems like in human nature, there's always been a need to live in community and to follow a spiritual rule and do some service for humanity. And it's the nature of us, I guess.
And for this community, why the prairie? Why the earth as a central feature?
Well, our land is very strategically located to Lake Mendota. And many, many years ago, when I was a young sister, the water that drains from this area, Fox Bluff area, went right through our land, you know, into under the bridge into Lake Mendota. And I remember the land was rented out to a farmer, and saying, somebody from the agricultural office saying, well, could we develop a watershed area or waterway through there? Could we enlarge what we did have? And so we talked to the farmer and did that. And we had these acres, and even though there was development starting around us, we said, well, we will try to keep this land intact and make it available for people. So we had, when the sisters first came here in 1953, we had a school, we had a retreat center, we had a camp for girls. And then when the Mendota Watershed Program started developing and people became really aware of what was draining into Lake Mendota from the farmland, from the golf course, from development, we said, we will participate in that. And what's more of a sieve than prairie?
So it's a great filter for some of the pesticides,
yes,
or
absolutely,
fertilizers.
Absolutely.
And it stops them from entering into Lake Mendota.
Right. So gradually we took out the farmland. Every year we would take out 10 acres. And we would prepare the land, and then we collected some seed from other prairie enthusiasts, and then we would let this seed fly. And I'm from Iowa, and I said, I don't know how this seed is ever going to grow. Nobody harrows it in. They just leave it though, and it's November. But that's what prairie seed does. And the next year it started growing, and then every year we did this until we took out all of the farmland and put it in prairie. And then it became more and more important for people to look at what was happening on their land. And we became more convinced that this is what we needed to do, especially as development grew all around us.
Sister Mary David is something of a misfit. She doesn't quite fit within her own Catholic tradition, even though she clearly identifies as Catholic, and I suspect she's not wholly embraced by the very diverse Protestant community. As a woman who's following the rule of Benedict, remaining celibate, having no husband or children or grandchildren, eschewing private ownership, I'm certain that Sister Mary David Waltenbach has virtually no credibility on Wall Street or the boardroom of Walmart or the lobby of the Waldorf Hotel. But I find her voice one of those under-listened to, under-appreciated voices worthy of the microphone from time to time, which is why she's on this podcast. This has been Voices from the Center, operating out of overturningtables.net. My thanks to Sister Mary David Waltenbach for her time, to St. Benedict for his monastic innovation, and to Philip for his editing skill. Until next time.